From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 2009 when NASA's Kepler mission launched. The Kepler Space Telescope was trained on a small portion of our sky, looking for planets. Specifically, Kepler was looking for what astronomers call a transit, which is when a planet passes between us and a star. That allows us to see the planet, essentially, when it blocks a tiny bit of light from the star. But then astronomers at Yale got to thinking, can we rely on the computers to analyze all of this data? What if the computers missed something? So the Yale astronomers created a Planet Hunters Project, a kind of citizen scientist gambit. I'm picturing average citizens coming home from work, sitting with a glass of wine in their sweatpants, analyzing data for fun. I have no idea if that's how it happens. But the bottom line is that the citizen planet hunters were hoping to find even one planet that the computers missed. Wouldn't that be cool? Well, they found one, they found another, they found dozens, and then they found something far more interesting and mysterious. They found a star the likes of which we had never seen. That's because there is something massive orbiting this star. How do we know? Well, the star's light would occasionally get dimmer, much dimmer, losing about 20% of its brightness, because something was passing in front of it. And that set off a debate about what could be surrounding the star. Another planet? Nope, a planet could not block that much light. Dust? Probably not. What about a Dyson sphere? And that's where it gets kind of weird. Scientists don't like to say aliens because, well, it's obvious. We have no evidence of aliens. But if a Dyson sphere did exist, this is very likely what it would look like to us. And that has the scientific community at least entertaining the notion of an alien civilization. So, by the way, what's a Dyson sphere? This hour we explore that and more. And let me welcome my guests. On the line with us from Yale is Dr. Tabitha Boyajian. She's an astronomer at Yale who's helping lead this research. And Tabitha, so great to have you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And Brian Koberline's in studio with me. He's a senior lecturer of physics and astronomy at RIT. And just this morning, he wrote a piece called An Alien Star for his blog, One Universe at a Time. Great to have you as well, Brian.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
Tabitha, take us back. You got involved with this project, what was it, 4 years ago?
Yeah, that's right. I came to Yale not knowing anything about citizen science or, you know, planet hunters for that matter, or, you know, how it works. And this is one of the projects they had going on. And it was a really exciting time because they'd already found, you know, a handful of planets and were, you know, getting ready to, you know, come out with, you know, a couple of dozen more that were new.
You got to tell me what these planet hunters are, because again, like I said, I've got this view that, you know, there are these volunteers, they dig science, they come home from work, they kick back in a home office and they just kind of go through the data. But I have no clue if that's the actual scenario. How does it work?
I think it could happen like that. It could happen in many ways. There is actually a link on the talk page, which is not in the main classify interface, but it's kind of like a discussion forum where, you know, users like introduce themselves and they come from all backgrounds, all around the world, you know, pretty much anywhere you can have internet. And it can be all ages. Like the way this is designed is that, you know, it's very simple. It's just using your, you know, brain's ability for pattern recognition to pick out signals in the data. You don't need to understand, you know, the physics or anything of that. If you want to know more, you can. There are tons of links and discussion boards on finding out, you know, what exactly you're looking at, and so you can learn more if you're curious. But you know, my kids are 4 and 7, and they do it. They definitely do not know what they're looking for, but it's simple enough that, you know, you can, you know, just anybody can do it because you're just looking for a pattern.
I have a 4-year-old. I am absolutely going to get him involved with this. He will think this is the coolest thing. So early on, you know, they're finding planets. And as you said in your TED Talk, and listeners, by the way, Tabby just did a TED Talk, which is outstanding, and we'll link to it on our Twitter pages, at Evan Dawson on Twitter and at MMAC Media for Megan Mack, producer of this program. You mentioned there that, you know, early on the idea was you want to catch what the computers might miss. And I kind of briefly described it, but tell us, our listeners, how they would kind of catch something the computers might not see.
Well, this was, you know, as I mentioned in the talk, you know, this was kind of not a favorable, you know, motivation to do something like this, because, I mean, you wouldn't think that computers would miss a periodic signal in just time series data. And so, but it turns up that, you know, we have, you know, found, you know, dozens and dozens of planets that they have missed. And this is, you know, for one reason or another, and we're able to work with the Kepler team, you know, to provide them feedback on where there are holes in their pipeline.
So as we look up at our night sky, this is a small portion of it, right, that Kepler's looking at? I mean, do we have a, how do you quantify what percentage of the sky is Kepler looking at?
It's, oh gosh, I think it's much less than, you know, a hundredth. I think it's around a hundredth of a percent of the sky. It's about as big as if you hold your fist out at arm's length. That's about as much of the sky that it's looking at.
And it's looking at roughly how many different stars?
It is looking at, or it was looking at, a little over 150,000 stars in that one area.
So a tiny bit of the universe, really, is when we look at it. And yet, this discovery happens that something funky is going on with one of these stars about 1,500 light years away. And I want you to kind of tell the story of how we first learned of that. You know, was it one of the citizen scientists saying, hey, we flagged this, it seems strange, we're going to go back to it, the data's, maybe the data's off, or what's the kind of step-by-step, how did that start to unfold?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it was. You know, somebody flagged it, and as I mentioned before, there's the main classification interface, and then when you're done classifying something, you can discuss that object on Talk, which is the discussion forum. And somebody tagged it as, you know, well, it's not a planet, but this is something that's really interesting, and it just got a lot of chatter, right? And so, you know, as the data kept coming in with, you know, the new downloads, this is when the Kepler mission was still flying. I mean, it's still flying now, but it can't look at the original field anymore. That's another story in itself. But, you know, as new data would come out, you know, they would, you know, come and, you know, check the star, you know, see if there was anything happening. And about halfway through the mission, there was a huge event that happened. And that definitely got, you know, even more chatter happening. And at the very end, there was just like this main, just huge complex of dipping features is what we call, you know, what's happening is dips, for lack of a better word. But yeah, so this is, you know, just kind of like, you know, how it was chatted up a good bit. You know, some of our what we call super users, which are, you know, users that are very experienced in not just, you know, the classification of data, but, you know, they've, you know, gone and took the initiative and learned how to do some, you know, vetting processes on, you know, if the data is good and such and such. You know, they did preliminary checks and they're like, well, you know, this is something that, you know, it looks real. Let's have the science team look at it. And that's how it came to me.
Was your first reaction, even though you've got these experienced citizen scientists checking it out and vetting it, that when you see a star that has something this unusual happening, that maybe there still is, you know, I think, well, there's a smudge on the lens. I have no idea. But is there something that is causing this to just be bad data? Or did you think immediately we have something very strange and probably legitimate here?
No, the initial reaction for everybody that sees it, including me, is that, you know, the data must be bad. And since, you know, the word came to me from, you know, very experienced users that said, you know, we've done these preliminary checks and the data is good, you know, it was like, okay, well, you know, I won't dismiss it right away. I'll look into it. And, you know, I, you know, went through kind of like, you know, a list of things that, you know, I can look at, see if, you know, the data was actually good or not. And everything passed. And then, you know, this, before you ask for telescope time or anything like that, you don't want to ask for it on an object because telescope time is very valuable. It's oversubscribed. And you don't want to get an observation of something that's really nothing, right? And so, you know, before we did any of this, like, you know, several people, you know, checked out the data to see it was good. We even had, you know, the Kepler team look at it. And they said, well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with the data that, you know, we can see with our analytics.
So what was next for you then? I mean, did that change your mind then to think that, okay, there is a star that we're looking at, the light of this star, and something unusual, and apparently it's not bad data, we just have no idea what's happening. You know, did you shift immediately into thinking what it could be?
Well, in a way, it's like, I mean, when you have something like that, you kind of just go through the scientific process of, you know, okay, like putting out an idea, testing it, okay, that isn't good. You know, putting out another idea, testing it, okay, that isn't good. And for something like this, I had no clue what, you know, what could be causing something like this. And so, like, I mean, it just took talking to a lot of people and bouncing ideas off of each other. And then, you know, we'd get some observations, some ground-based observations to help characterize the star and, you know, what could be around the star possibly. So we get, you know, a spectrum of the star. And so we could tell its stellar properties a lot better than what, you know, the Kepler team, you know, their catalog has. It's just from broadband photometry. Spectrum would actually give you better details on what, you know, what the evolutionary state and the temperature and the mass and everything of the star is. And so it just took a bit of time to, you know, kind of learn what you were dealing with and then go ahead and start to test different theories out.
My guest is Dr. Tabitha Boyajian, an astronomer who's helping lead this research that in the last few months you might have seen some of the headlines, you know, strange star, most mysterious star in the galaxy, the Atlantic Monthly called it, a star with alien megastructures, probably not alien megastructures, but we're getting there because the question on what is surrounding this star, it's important to at least also explain, Tabitha, for listeners who don't do this kind of research, okay, you found this star and you've got these big dips in light, that in other words, it's normally X brightness and then every once in a while, you get this big dip in brightness. Something is passing between us and the star. So people would say, well, why not a planet? You know, Earth isn't a huge planet, but why not a Jupiter-sized planet? What would a Jupiter-sized planet do to dim the light? Could it be a Jupiter-sized planet?
The dips in the light are quite large. First of all, the dip any object will make is proportional to the star itself. And so a Jupiter crossing a sunlight star will make a 1% drop in light. This star is slightly larger. It's about 50% larger. And so it would make, you know, only a 0.5% drop. And so to get 20% drop in light, you would need 50-something Jupiters to reproduce this signal.
So it's not a Jupiter. It's not a planet, in other words.
Correct.
Okay. And then another idea was, well, it could be dust. Maybe it's a very young star and there's still dust left over from the kind of formation event. Or maybe it's an old star and there's dust and debris hanging around it. What did you find with that?
So this theory, the dust theory actually is what, you know, gave most of our scenarios the biggest trouble is that when we look at this star, you see, you know, its output in light at all wavelengths. And if you have dust going around it, it would glow, say, like in the very long wavelengths in the infrared. And we saw no evidence of this glowing in the infrared. And so that kind of rules out any kind of dust scenario that you can put around it, whether the star was young or whether you had a planet-planet collision and that produced a lot of dust and that's, you know, sporadically blocking out a bunch of the light.
Okay, and what about comets? So another theory is that, another idea, I should say, is that it could be a bunch of comets, maybe full comets, maybe, I don't know, collided and fragmented comets orbiting the star. So occasionally, when those fragmented comets pass in between us and the star, we get this big drop in light, and that's the answer. What have we learned about that possibility so far?
So that is the best possibility we have to explain what is happening. It is consistent with all of our observations. The reason why it escapes the lack of infrared glow or infrared excess, as we say, from dust, is that comets are on very elliptical orbits. And so you would only get this sort of glow if the material is very close when you're taking that infrared observation. And that is for a very short period of time. And so this is the most, you know, it's the best natural scenario that we have so far. Preliminary modeling that has come out has shown that, you know, they were able to model like the last 2 months of the light curve. And they did it fairly well. But it showed that, you know, you would need, you know, several hundred giant comets to, you know, fall into the star, you know, just in this one small time period to reproduce the data. So that's, you know, it's kind of a stretch, but, you know, who knows? Nature could do all sorts of funny things.
Okay, so that is the best of a series of bad possible ideas so far. Is that a fair characterization, Tabitha?
That's right.
Okay, so have we ever seen another star that has this many comets surrounding it behaving in this way?
We know of comets around other stars. These so-called exocomets are typically found around very what we call early-type stars. So these are A-type stars. They're several thousand degrees hotter than our own star, the Sun, and this KIC star, KIC 8462852. And they're also very young. And we've never actually seen the dust component. So what we're seeing, you know, if what we're seeing in, you know, our star's light curve is due to dust blocking out the starlight, we've never actually seen that in another star. We've seen the gas component of comets.
Just to illustrate for our listeners, by the way, how unusual this is, this star has been given several names. Some call it Tabby Star, for my guest, Tabitha Boyajian. Its official designation, KIC 8462852. In your paper, though, Tabby, you called it the WTF star, which, by the way, get our minds out of the gutter. WTF stands for what, Tabby?
Where's the flux?
Where, you had some fun with that, didn't you?
Well, it was cleverly chosen, yes.
and that publication comes out, and you kind of settled on, or I want to say settled on, is it fair to say in that publication, in that first writing, that you said, okay, so maybe comets is the best of the lot so far, yeah, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Okay, that takes us to the alien part, because if it's not comets, it must obviously be aliens, because there's nothing else left, even though, as we'll talk about with Brian Koberline coming up here, I'm sure there are other possible explanations, but did you at any point say to a colleague or have a colleague say to you, you know, if this is a Dyson sphere, that's what it would look like? Or, you know, did you say, look, it's not aliens. We don't want to be pilloried by the scientific community as being the ones who claim to have found aliens and didn't. You know, what were those early conversations like?
You know, it did come up, you know, several years ago by, I think, you know, one of our citizen scientists who, you know, were like, hey, you know, what about, you know, something like this? And, you know, it's something you kind of, you know, laugh about and you quickly dismiss. But then, you know, I did meet with my colleague, Jason Wright, and he was actually working on a paper that was studying this exact thing, whether or not Kepler could detect, you know, some sort of alien megastructure in Kepler data. And, you know, he went through several different scenarios of, you know, interesting objects that have been found, you know, and explained the, you know, pros and cons. But, you know, essentially each object that he discussed had a natural explanation to it. And that's, you know, when I showed him this data, he was like, oh, well, wait a minute. You know, if you don't have an natural explanation and, you know, it's been thoroughly scrubbed by, I don't know, several dozen, you know, astronomers, you know, this might be something that's, you know, worth pursuing in this respect.
And what did you think? Did you think this is loony, or did you think, oh, interesting, interesting possibility?
I mean, the approach is definitely solid. You know, he was writing a paper that was published in the Astrophysical Journal, which is a very, you know, highly respected journal. But I myself was a little worried because I'm a junior astronomer, and I kind of didn't want to get mixed up in anything that was a little eccentric like this, because, I mean, it kind of makes you look like, you know, you're giving up on physics and, you know, just saying, oh, kind of, you know, getting way far out there.
In other words, it sounds like you are aware that your reputation is, in some ways, on the line here. I mean, your name is all over the news internationally, I think, fair to say, with this. But were you worried about sort of overly being associated with this alien idea, Tabby?
Yes, I was. And I mean, it's already happened. My name was already on it. And so, you know, and I thought, you know, okay, well, if we test this idea, right, and if we look, if we do SETI observations on this star, if we look, then, you know, we can learn something and, you know, rule something out. And that itself had value to it.
Well, I think this is where what we should do is explain to listeners what a Dyson sphere is and, you know, to the extent that if it exists at all in the universe, you know, what it might look like and why, at the very least, we are very broadly and loosely entertaining this idea with this star. So a Dyson sphere goes back to what, Tebby? What's the story there? What is a Dyson sphere?
Dyson sphere goes back to Freeman Dyson, who it's named after, and he was working on the idea of other civilizations that had exhausted their energy supply of their home planet, and what are they going to do? It goes back to Moore's law, right? How technical advances seem to rise exponentially, and so it'll happen here on our planet Earth at some point in time in the future, where we've exhausted everything here, fossil fuels and all that, and if we cover the whole planet with solar panels, and we still don't have enough energy to suffice our needs, then what do we do? And so the idea is that you build out in space, like surrounding your planet and orbiting your host star, more solar panels so you can collect the sun's light, and so you can use that for energy.
And so these panels, a Dyson sphere or a Dyson swarm, some people call them, of massive, they would have to be massive structures, would they not?
That's right. For something that we would observe in, surrounding, this one star, if you have a 20% block in this star's light, and that is coming from some, artificial structure, then you would need something enormous, much, much bigger than, our Earth or Jupiter or anything like that. It would have to be enormous to block out that much light.
Brian Koberlein, Senior Lecturer of Physics and Astronomy at RIT. The scientific community views Dyson swarms or Dyson spheres generally with
extreme skepticism.
Extreme skepticism, sure, because we've never had any evidence that they exist.
Right. And we've also done searches for them. So there has been, at least some cursory searches of evidence of Dyson spheres or indirect evidence, and we haven't found anything.
But just today, Brian wrote about Tabby's star, and let me go ahead and quote, if I could, from Brian's blog, One Universe at a Time, if you don't mind, and then I'd like you to kind of expound on that. Today's post is called An Alien Star, and you wrote, in all honesty, it could be aliens, but even that seems to be contradicted by evidence. If the dimming were caused by some kind of alien superstructure, then the blocked light being captured would emit some of that energy as heat. Based on the data, the alien superstructure would be absorbing about 20% of the star's light, and that would generate a great deal of waste heat. So there should be an excess of infrared light coming from the star, but observations have found no significant infrared excess. That doesn't mean aliens are ruled out, but they aren't any more compelling than some strange natural phenomena. In short, it's a mystery, and that is definitely worth studying further. So tell me a little bit more about that. Do you view the lack of heat or radiation is a big flag in saying probably not a Dyson sphere here, Brian?
I think that combined with the SETI observations that have no radio signals, you would think that, if there is an alien civilization that's creating this large superstructure or has created this large superstructure, the infrared excess should be there in most kind of Dyson sphere ideas. And you would think that there would be some type of stray radio signal that we would pick up.
Aha, but Brian and Tabby, what if this is an old, burned-out shell of a Dyson sphere that goes back, millions and millions of years, and it's a long-since dormant or left civilization? You're laughing, don't laugh. Why not? Why not?
Well, I think, when it comes to science, could you come up with a hypothetical scenario in which an alien superstructure does explain all of this data? Yes. However, one of the great sayings in science is, tweak models are weak models. If you're just going to tweak your model in order to fit the data and you just keep tweaking it, it's not a very compelling model.
Let me stress again for the audience that's listening, Tabitha Boyajian, my guest on the line, is not advocating that it is a Dyson sphere, even though so many of us would love it to be, Tabby.
I would too, but I don't think any of us is really advocating that this is a very great idea for all the reasons that our colleague had just mentioned.
I want to get you on board because this would be the coolest idea. Do you agree, Tabitha, that what Brian is saying about sort of a heat signature or radiation, the lack of such from this star, is a sign that we're probably not looking at a Dyson sphere?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's I mentioned before, the lack of infrared excess, like, you know, definitely ruled out most of our, you know, natural scenarios. And it also doesn't fit to be consistent with the Dyson sphere scenario. You know, as I mentioned in my TED talk, you know, if you're already invoking aliens, then, you know, you can just say, okay, well, they're re-radiating the heat in another direction. You know, who's to say they're not doing that? And so that, you know, it just introduce more variables and, you know, use your imagination. And of course, you know, you can come up with something that's consistent, but, you know, when you have a model with, you know, X to the N number of free variables, then it just becomes a less believable model. The SETI searches, the radio SETI searches around this star that have been happening are continuing to happen because, and a disclaimer, I'm not a SETI astronomer. I'm learning as we go. But these are continuing. They're going deeper. And they're also, you know, it could be time variable signals as well. And so just that this source presents itself as a very interesting target for SETI type, you know, searches, doesn't mean we're going to find anything there. And if, you know, you don't find anything on the first pointing, doesn't mean that you don't need to look anymore. It just needs continued observation.
Absolutely. And that's why Tabby and the researchers who care about this project need some help here. And there is a chance to do that. If you jump on my Twitter account, at Evan Dawson, you'll find that they're kind of crowdfunding it. Tabby, tell us about what you're doing right now.
So right now we're crowdfunding future research for this star. We're trying to raise money to not do a SETI search, but we're actually doing a kind of, you know, cross-discipline search on, you know, what's going to happen with the star, when is the next dip going to happen. And this Kickstarter, we're using Kickstarter as a platform, is going to raise money for 1 year of observing this star so we can monitor it and catch it when it's in a dip again. And when we do catch it in a dip, we'll be able to get a lot more sensitive observations to find out what kind of material it is that is passing in front of it. It'll tell us, you know, it'll give us information on, you know, what does this have to do with the previous dips in the Kepler data. And, you know, if we don't do it, you know, we'll never know.
we'll never know that it's an alien megastructure. See, look,
yeah.
I'm going to come back to that. I know I've said this on this program before. I'm going to say this again. First of all, we're always wary of confirmation bias. And this is where I think the scientific community does so well. Of course, everybody wants it to be aliens. And yet everybody is doing their darndest to make sure they prove that it is not. That's part of the scientific process. You don't fall prey to confirmation bias. But, you know, Epicurus, in several hundred years B.C., he came up with an idea of atoms. They didn't have anything close to being able to see the building blocks of life, but he knew that it was a good possibility they existed. He had ideas for what they might look like, and it took, 2,000 years almost before we could do it, but it was done. And Freeman Dyson and his colleagues had an idea for what a Dyson sphere might look like if there are other civilizations out there that are technological and that want to travel and colonize their own galaxy, and they need energy and they want to use their host star. And if they exist, they would probably start showing up to us something like this. Okay, there's not radiation. Brian Koberline ruining it for all of us. But
that's what I do.
what I want to do is I want to get our only break of the hour, and I want to come back because I've got listener questions that have come in. I would love to hear what Brian kind of wants to probe here, you know, with Tabitha Boyajian. We'll tell you again how you can help fund the ongoing research for this project and get to more of the questions about the WTF star, the Where's the Flux star, as we talk with Tabby Boyajian and Brian Koberline next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, President Obama visits Hiroshima. That sets off a debate about whether the trip was appropriate. Now, the president said he would not apologize, and Japanese protesters said he should have. But some critics have said it was a de facto apology that shouldn't have happened. Others say it was a bridge to more cultural understanding. Our panel debates it. Join the conversation next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our conversation this hour about the most mysterious star in the galaxy goes back to the work that's being done not only by Kepler, but by citizen scientists, planet hunters, who have been looking at this data, and they encountered a star that was unusual to say the least, a star whose light and brightness dimmed by about, again, Tabby, about 20% or so. Is that correct, or is it more?
I think the deepest dip is about 22%.
22%, which is an enormous dip in light for a star, and it's currently unexplained what's causing that dip. What is surrounding the star to do that? We don't yet know. Of course, we're having a little fun with the idea that it's an alien megastructure, but at the same time, as Adam Frank and others have recently written, we should at least be adults enough to now say that we shouldn't snicker when we bring up that idea that we, even if this is not a Dyson sphere, even if this is not an alien megastructure, we might eventually find one. And we shouldn't laugh at that possibility, because there's probably all kinds of life out there, Adam writes. So we're talking to Tabitha Boyajian, who's working with this group, and one of our listeners named Mark wants to know. He says, this sounds great. How can I become one of those citizen scientists? Tabitha, can people sign up to help?
Yes, you can help in a couple of different ways. So the Planet Hunters Project, you can sign up there, and I mean, it's pretty easy. You just get an account, you go through a 2-minute tutorial, and then you're on classifying light curves, and you can help find planets or, you know, other stars like this one, if they're out there. You can also help by joining our group on the Kickstarter. So any donation that, you know, you are comfortable with, like we got, you know, numerous rewards for, you know, several dozen different tiers that you can choose from. And so that will help, you know, further the observations of this star so we can figure out what it is.
Sarah writes to the program and wants to know an answer that I suspect Tabitha is going to say. She's not going to answer this because scientists don't do this, but Sarah says, I'm dying to know, what does your guest actually think that thing is? And my guess is you want more evidence. But Tabby, Sarah wants to know, she's dying to know, what do you actually think that is?
Yep. I mean, you're right. We need more data. And we can't say for sure with any of the data that we have. We need more data. We need to catch it in a dip again.
Okay. Would you be surprised at this point if it's comets, Tabby?
It would be an extremely interesting result.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think any solution would be very surprising and very exciting. Because
listen,
we have exhausted so many different scenarios.
Yeah, listeners, if you want to call the program, I'll read more of your emails in a moment here. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Tabitha Boyajian, Dr. Boyajian, how has your life changed since this stuff came out? I mean, you've given a TED Talk. I see headlines in major newspapers around the world about this. Are you sort of blown away by the reaction to this work?
That's a very good way of putting it. Yes, blown away. I was completely overwhelmed at first. Blown away. I'm still pretty overwhelmed. It is pretty exciting. Like I get emails from, you know, so many people, you know, daily, and, you know, it's kind of nice to, you know, just read something from somebody saying, you know, I'm an accountant, I don't really think about this stuff, but I read this article and I would just want to say it was very interesting. Thank you. You know, like, and I think that's, you know, as a scientist, I think that's great, because it is kind of reaching out to people who don't really think about science every day. And there is some value in that. And that's kind of what's kept me going through all this other craziness that's going on.
Well, there's a Kickstarter to help with further research on the star known variously as Tabby Star, the WTF Star, the KIC8462852, the Kickstarter we've linked to on our Twitter page to fund the most mysterious star in the galaxy, research on it. And it says right there, help astronomers get the data they need to unravel one of the biggest mysteries of all time. That, you know, that's not an overstatement at this point. So before I read some more listener questions, Brian Koberline, Senior Lecturer of Astrophysics at RIT. Brian, for you, do you think that there are other explanations that we haven't even considered? In other words, and this is, again, going to be hard to answer, but what's the possibility that this is something that is not aliens, but it's also not anything that we currently understand?
I think that's a possibility. I mean, if it's one of the jokes about theoretical physicists is that if you give them the data and ask them for a model, they can give you three. You know, so when you get weird data like this, theorists will always come up with interesting ideas. And when that doesn't work, they'll just dig deeper into wilder and crazier ideas. So there are ideas out there. Maybe they're right. Probably they're not. But you know, it's a fun time.
Okay. And Tabitha, what do you make of that question? It could be something that's not an alien megastructure, but it's also not something we currently have experienced or understand. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely a true statement. And, you know, it is pretty exciting that, you know, you can still find, you know, new things out in space. And, you know, data like this is just, you know, regular time series data. And the fact that, you know, we weren't even looking for something like this, we're looking for planets, and the signal was huge, kind of, you know, says something, you know, about it. You know, maybe there is more out there. We've only seen, you know, viewed a certain part of the sky. And astronomy in itself is an observationally driven field, you know, like, yeah.
Well, speaking of the opportunity to observe and just how small of a section of sky Kepler was taking a look at when this mysterious star was discovered. Jake writes to us, one of our listeners named Jake is, Jake should be hosting these science shows. I should just be just kind of deferring to him. Here's what he writes on this one. He says, I get a little bit of a chuckle when the media latches onto stories like these, mainly because they, like the general public, don't have a healthy understanding of the numbers. So this star is the only one even close to like it in the Kepler survey. One in 150,000, if you assume it's actually 10 times more than that, so one in 1.5 million. That means there could be as many as 67,000 objects like this out there just in our galaxy alone. Ask your guest about the LSST, the Large Synaptic Survey Telescope, that comes online in 2021 that is planning to map the whole available sky every night for a decade, which is 400 times more sky area and five times the duration that Kepler did. It's a long waiting game, but the most interesting stuff is yet to come. That's from Jake. Tabby, what do you think of that?
I absolutely agree. There's the LSST. There's a couple of space surveys that are coming out. One is the test mission, the NASA test mission, and that's not going to look for, you know, that long period of time. Most of the stars it's going to survey will only have 30 days or so worth of coverage. But there will be some with, you know, a good bit, you know, up to, you know, a couple hundred days of coverage. And this is also surveying, you know, most of the sky. There's some European space missions that are coming up that are kind of, you know, cover, you know, a few more million stars. It really is an exciting time for astronomy right now. And so we can, you know, start to look for, you know, similar objects like this. And maybe it's a, you know, certain class of you know, objects of that's undergoing some sort of phenomenon. We don't know. But, you know, we only have one right now that fits this bill.
Yep. Brian, what do you think?
I would agree. I think, you know, over the next few years, this story is going to be one among many. Because as we get large sky surveys, we're going to have much more data. And the other thing about this is that many of the surveys, like LSST, the data is actually going public immediately. So anyone can start combing this stuff.
Now Brian says we're going to find more, maybe not exactly like the WTF star, but more odd things. Though Tabby concludes her TED Talk with a great question, and I will only say you should watch her TED Talk and listen to her closing line because it's quite provocative. But let me read a couple of tweets from a listener, a different Brian. Brian Halligan writes to us. First of all, he says, I'm holding out hope for an alien megastructure, but if it's dust from some catastrophic event, that's really interesting too. What kind of catastrophic event, Tabby, could this listener be talking about?
A catastrophic event that they could be talking about would be one that I had mentioned in the talk is that, you know, say you have a planet that had collided. And, you know, during this, much like the Earth-Moon forming event. So, like, you know, we think that an asteroid named Theia, you know, crashed into the Earth when it was, you know, just being formed. And that kind of, you know, blew the two of them up. And you know, then the Earth formed itself and then the Moon formed itself around the Earth. And so this sort of event would be some sort of catastrophic classified event.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. Oh, I'm also looking at Brian Koberline, thinking of recent conversations we had about the discovery of this new massive planet on the farther out in our own solar system, Brian, that we haven't actually observed, but we have evidence that may exist.
Yeah, I wouldn't say discovery, but,
okay,
but
okay.
Hence pointing in that direction.
Okay, right, because at the same time that story was breaking, you had these conspiracy theories or these sort of wild stories that this planet not only exists, but it's going to come wallop the Earth and that'll be the end of us. And you were quick to squash that idea.
It's not happening.
Okay, but in this case, with Tabby Star, maybe we saw some kind of catastrophic event in that sort of family of events. So perhaps. Brian follows up to ask, will the NASA Webb telescope help narrow down the possibilities for what is causing the dimming of the WTF star? Tabby?
The James Webb Space Telescope, it will be equipped with the very sensitive infrared instruments, and this will definitely help constrain whatever kind of dusty material, if it's there and if it's just very not very abundant, it will be able to help us constrain, what is surrounding this star.
Okay. Brian Koberline, for you, what stands out as, what are your big questions going forward? You know, if you had a chance to work with Dr. Boyajian on this and you had, you wanted to satisfy more curiosity, what stands out in your mind about the WTF star?
I want more data on the dipping. I mean, the big dips is fascinating to me because they shouldn't be. How do you get a dip that big? That's of course the ultimate question here, but I want more data.
Yeah, and I guess that's where we're headed. Tabby, the current Kickstarter number I'm seeing is around $36,000 raised. You got a long way to go. 100,000 is the target number, right?
That's right.
All right.
We got just 13 days.
13 days.
And it's all or nothing. So Yeah, there's a sense of urgency there. We need to meet our goal.
Okay, and so if you want to contribute, again, we've posted a link to their Kickstarter page there. David on Twitter says, the variety of topics Evan Dawson and Megan Mack tackle on Connections is astounding. Well, this was an easy one. For me, this was a great, fun kind of a topic. And if you've missed any of it, I would encourage you to check out the article that the Atlantic Monthly published called The Most Mysterious Star in the Galaxy. We've also posted a link to that. But if you missed the earlier part of our discussion, Mary is writing in saying, Evan, I understand the alien megastructure idea. I don't understand how you actually look at the light of a star. That's a good question. It's a great question, Mary. So Tabitha Boyajian, can you explain to our listener named Mary, how you actually do the analysis to say, here's a star, here's how we know its light has dipped 1%, here's how we know its light has dipped 22%. How do you do that?
Well, it's a method called photometry, and what we're doing is time series photometry. So we just take a measurement of the star's light over time, and we do this at several different what we call colors. So we do it in a blue color, and then we do it in a red color. And this is what the Kepler Space Telescope actually wasn't able to provide us because it only did one color. But from the ground, with our Kickstarter campaign, we will be monitoring the star with a network of telescopes that will have the observations will be in different colors. And so when the star starts to dip again, we'll have information at these different colors and how whatever kind of material is passing in front of the star will have a different signature if it's, say, dust as opposed to some sort of extremely opaque material. Opaque material, like artificial Dyson sphere or something like that, or a planet, or what have you. It'll have a different signature in the dips in each color. And so, if we have a different, if we have a dip with a depth of one value in the blue color and then another one in the red color, and that is the same depth, and that will tell us something as opposed to something, if there was different depths in the blue color and the red color.
Okay. And I also read recently that there was somebody, I don't remember the name, somebody who is kind of trained to look at photographs of the night sky by eye to look at a star's brightness and to kind of determine it, and that was part of this process of trying to identify over time with this star how much dimming was going on. Did that happen?
Right. So this is something that came up after the discovery of this, was that analysis was done with these old photographic plate archives. So these are measurements that date back over 100 years. And you know, they were looking at the star and they found this very interesting trend that this star was 20% brighter 100 years ago, which stars, as we know of, really are not supposed to do that at all.
So everything about this star is, this has been unusual from the beginning here. So as we start to wrap up the conversation, just a few more questions for Dr. Tabitha Boyajian, not the least of which I think is, what do you, you know, do you think about the importance of this star, Tabby? In other words, if it's aliens, if it's an alien megastructure, that's a hugely important question. But if it's not, even if it is a series of comet fragments, the likes of which we've never seen around a star, or something else that, that the likes of which we've never seen around a star, do you think about the importance of this work? Do you think about the implications? Or are you just trying to collect data and sort of let the rest of the scientific world figure out the rest?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's what science is all about, you know, discovering something new. And so, I mean, I think it is kind of, you know, part of our job description is to, you know, do something like this. This star in itself is like such a handful. I mean, it's kind of a love-hate relationship because, you know, there's no immediate answer or, you know, that you can kind of like hang on to and say, okay, yes, you know, like, you know, we have this. And so, you know, it kind of leaves you in a very awkward position. But I mean, it's just, it is, you know, something that would otherwise be sitting on my desk for, you know, for forever if, you know, we didn't write this paper on, you know, it was seemingly a very boring result because there was no real result for, you know, the paper. It was just kind of like, okay, well, you know, this is, you know, all the things that we came up with and we can't really find it, you know, we have one solution that's not so great, but, you know, here you go. And so, yeah, it's an interesting position to be in, but, you know, that's it. It is science, and, you know, that's why we love it.
And do you think about the fact that, you know, even if you can raise $100,000 over the next 13 days, and they're still $64,000 away, you can go to their Kickstarter page for Tabby Star to help. Even if you raise that money and you get to do more observation and you get more data over time, have you grappled with the idea that in our lifetimes we may never know the answer to what is surrounding this star?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, it's kind of, it's described in our Kickstarter page on the risks is that, you know, we don't, this thing is not periodic. You know, when it's going to dip, we have no idea when that is going to happen. But if we don't look, we'll never know.
Brian Koberlein, when we talked about Pluto, even just all of the information we got on NASA's flyby, we also got more mysteries. And that's sort of the tease of astronomy. That's the tease of space. It's the fascinating mystery that as we learn more, we learn there's more that we don't know. Isn't that unfair? I mean, that is totally unfair.
No, I think, you know, science is about not only answering questions, but also being used to other questions you don't have answers to. Because every answer you have is going to raise some other questions down the line. It never stops with the questioning. We're like a five-year-old that just keeps asking, why, how, why, how?
And Brian does a great job every day of helping us sort of at least understand those questions. In his blog, you can read his work at One Universe at a Time, very easy to find. Dr. Boyajian, good luck to you. And I hope we can talk again because I find it fascinating. You know, a couple weeks ago we talked to an astrophysicist from the University of Rochester who put together an equation that essentially says if we are the only technological civilization in the universe, then there are 10 billion trillion Earth-like planets out there that have nothing but amoeba, and that just doesn't seem all that likely. I'm not saying your star has got the alien megastructure that proves that we're not alone, but I'm saying that I think he's right to say we shouldn't snicker at the possibility, and I hope that you get more data and more chance to observe because I'm fascinated. So thank you so much for taking the time for us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Tabitha Boyajian, Dr. Boyajian's work, you can learn a lot more online. We've put various sources on there. Her TED Talk is outstanding. A lot of fun this hour. So we'll see. Or maybe we won't see. That's the sad thing, as Brian says. Maybe the cruelty is that we won't, but maybe we will. Thank you, Brian Koberlein, for coming. I always like talking to you as well.
Thank you for
having me. Great fun. Let's get a short break, and much more Connections on this Friday afternoon is next.